Welcome to a fabulous segment. I want to take a moment, and you know, many of us have parents, grandparents that, you know, were part of what we know as World War II. World War II. And as my uncle would say to me, you had to be there to appreciate it. And yet we live in a pop culture where we've seen so many movies, so many documentaries on what it was like. But what is it about those men and women that stood their ground for us in that war? What was it about them? How much do you actually know about the people that have been, how should I say it, honored and revered for the things they've done? Today, Dr. Brian Mark Rigg is joining me here today, and we are going to talk about the last World War II Medal of Honor recipient. What do you think this individual may have done?
Well, you know, the Medal of Honor is the highest medal for valor that our nation bestows on a serviceman or woman for going beyond the call of duty. And to kind of put it in the context, just in World War II, you know, we had 16.3 million people who served our nation during World War II, and only around 480 got the Medal of Honor. Mm. And in the Marine Corps, which we'll be talking about, because that's where Woody Williams served, you had 669,100 Marines during World War II, and only 82 got the Medal of Honor. And so, you know, it is a very elite group. These people have to do extraordinary actions in order to get it. And once they get it, in American lore, in American society, American military, they get pushed up to Mount Olympus of military gods and heroes in our nation. I mean, if these people walk into a room, even if they have the rank of like sergeant, like Woody did at the end of World War II, generals are supposed to stand up and salute, and they salute the medal. The medal takes on a life of its own, and it's symbolic of the sacrifice of whatever campaign those people were a part of, and they become spokesmen for the men and women who can no longer speak, who gave the ultimate sacrifice. So this medal has deep, deep significance for what it represents as far as freedom is not free, that these men and women, they went into harm's way and they helped their comrades and they did extraordinary things that pushed the campaign that they were most likely in to victory. And so there's a lot of things that kind of like surround the Medal of Honor that people need to be aware of and why it is such a powerful medal when somebody gets that tied around their neck.
Yeah, I want to just tell everybody, joining me here today, Dr. Brian Mark Rigg, and by the way, the author of more than one book, the author of more than one conversation. You know, you'll be able to take a look at the body of his work. We'll let you know how to do that, how to find him. You know, everything from looking at Hitler's Jewish soldiers, additional books on World War II and the Holocaust, and then his latest book, which I totally relate to, being in this group of people, conquering learning disabilities at any age. So clearly for you, a life path that you have laid out is a life path of really looking at how these folks who otherwise may go unnoticed in the world, but then show up. You know, they show up in a way and we step back from it and we think about this. But, you know, we're talking about flamethrower, right? Iwo Jima Medal of Honor recipient, U.S. Marine, Woody Williams. And the note that, I don't know, a controversial award. How so? How so controversial?
Well, you know, this is one thing I really did a deep dive into is like, how do we make our heroes? How do we give this medal? And, you know, Commandant of the Marine Corps, who's my mentor, and he also endorsed the work, 29th Commandant of the Marine Corps, Al Gray, said, Brian, you've educated me more about how medals of honor were given during World War II and just given, period, than any other person I've read. And so I'm that's a badge of honor that I do wear. So mm-hmm. Now getting to your question, why is this a controversial award for Woody? Well, I did a deep dive into 20 case studies from Iwo Jima. 27 men got the Medal of Honor from Iwo Jima. Woody was one of them. Out of out of 80,000 men who rotated on and off that island in combat, just kind of put it in perspective.
Wow.
And so as I was looking into Woody's medal, you know, this is a very involved process that when your company commander or your platoon commander puts together the package and pushes it up the chain of command, it has to go through several levels before it ever gets to the President of the United States. So Woody's package was thrown together, in many respects, in a very messy way, but it made it through the regiment level, you know, 3,000 men. It made it to the division level, 20,000 men. It made it to the corps level, which is three divisions, you know, about 60, 70,000 men. And then when it reached the Fleet Marine Corps level, Roy S. Geiger, famous Marine Corps general, he and his board realized that what was written up in the sample citation and in the first endorsement letter was not supported by the affidavits. And he and his board then conferred with none other than Pacific Commander, Fleet Admiral Chester Nimitz, and his board, and asked them what they thought about this. And they agreed with Geiger that this package was all messed up, and they were not going to push it forward. They did not sign off on Woody Williams' Medal of Honor package. But they found out in this time period that they might have a chance to figure out why there were so many discrepancies, because Woody's platoon commander had survived the war, but he had not been asked for an affidavit. But he had trained with Woody for 6 months. His name was Lieutenant Howard Chambers. He had commanded the action that Woody was a part of that got him, you know, eventually the Medal of Honor. So they wrote him directly and said, hey, can you help us out with giving an affidavit to clarify the problems here? And he refused to support Woody. He was asked again, and he still refused to support Woody. And 31st Commandant of the Marine Corps, Charles Krulak, who looked over this with me because I was very disturbed by it, if you will, he said, this is messed up when somebody's platoon leader refuses to endorse him. There's something really wrong here. So Geiger was right to stop the process. Well, during this time that they're trying to figure out whether Woody deserves the medal or not, and they put the brakes on it, President Truman is putting a lot of pressure on Secretary of the Navy, James Forrestal, to get him a live Medal of Honor recipients to award medals to in a Rose Garden ceremony on the 5th of October, 1945. A good feel ceremony, a political, bipartisan, and presidents love this. But he didn't want to give medals to weeping mothers or weeping widows. He wanted to give it to alive, strong, strapping young men. And so he was putting pressure on Forrestal. Forrestal put pressure on the Marine Corps and Chester Nimitz, and they said under no circumstances did he push this forward. Well, eventually they actually pulled it away from the chain of command. Woody's medal never got the endorsement of the Commandant of the Marine Corps at the time, General Vandergriff, or the Fleet Marine Force Commander, General Geiger, or the Pacific Commander, Fleet Admiral Chester Nimitz. And it was fast-tracked in the halls of Washington, and it was politically pushed through. That's why it is such a controversial medal, because in many respects, under normal circumstances, it appears it should have never happened.
Yeah. And you know what I love about this story? First of all, thank you for shedding some light on this. By the way, thank you for shedding some light across the board on this and the mission, because I was really struck by, I think, one of the first paragraphs in your book, and I will apologize if I actually get the language wrong, but I think in your dedication, something like to my sons, Ian, Justin, and even your daughter, I think was Sophia, you know, may they never have to face another Iwo Jima. However, you know, like if they do, may they be the first to volunteer for such a mission. That is the way my relatives felt as well. Now, many of us know about Iwo Jima. We know about it. How do I know about it? We lost an uncle. We lost an uncle there. And why is it that we don't know enough about what this was about and how significant this was to the war going one way or the other, right? Do you agree that this was very significant?
Oh, absolutely. A very significant battle. People don't know an awful lot about it. We have to thank, in many respects, Clint Eastwood for making the two movies he did in 2006, Letters from Iwo Jima and Flags of Our Fathers, for getting this story out there. But, you know, the one thing I was shocked, you know, when you ask, why do we not know about this more? Well, one side, our society, in many respects, does not support financially historians.
Right.
You know, a lot of people who do write history books, they are professors, and they have their duties in the classroom, and there's only so much time they can dedicate to doing research. And a lot of times, historians that are out there doing a lot of work, if you read their books, they're taking three or four books and making one out of them. They don't do a lot of historical research. When I went to 18 different museums and archives in five different countries to write this book. I went to Japan, I went to China, I went to Germany, America, and Guam to do this research. And, you know, half of my 3,145 footnotes are from primary sources.
Mm.
And what I was shocked by, Pat, is when I went into the National Archives in College Park, Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C., or the National Archives in St. Louis for the personnel files, quite often when they would bring me the original documents, and sometimes the very high-ranking individuals who were, you know, dictating the strategy of the battle at Iwo Jima, and were key personalities, a lot of times I was looking at documents that hadn't been looked at since World War II. How do I know this? Many of the documents were actually still in the envelopes, the manila envelopes, stapled shut with the seal on it, top secret from 1945. And wow. I had to go to the main archivist to hopefully open this up, and they did. They take the staples out and then let you look at the documents. So what, when you ask, why do people not know about this more? Well, first of all, a lot of the primary sources aren't looked at enough, and some of them haven't even been looked at, and we don't have a society that supports the culture of getting that history out. There is so much to be had learning about this history. Now, saying that, we do have a lot of books out there, nonetheless, and we do have a lot of people who are researching it, but we definitely need more. Me finding out all this 70 years after the fact shows you that there's a lot to be done. But, you know, nonetheless, when you go to Barnes & Noble and so on, there's a lot of books on this, but there should be more. And there should be more events like what happened yesterday when I was in Washington, D.C., to see Woody lying in honor in the rotunda of the Capitol, symbolic of all the sacrifices that men and women did during World War II, getting that in the news. This is another way of getting that information out there. But, you know, I'm the first one in 70-plus years to sit down and actually write about an enlisted man, a true biography of an enlisted man from World War II, John Hoffman, who was the former head of the Historical Division of the Marine Corps and famous author of Chessy, said that my work was the first good faith effort to document an enlisted man from the Marine Corps from World War II. Now think about that. You had almost 600,000 enlisted men in the Marine Corps during World War II. I'm the first one to really write a biography. So there's a need to do a lot more. It kind of reminds me of E.B. White, who said, every morning I wake up and there's a side of me that wants to save the world and there's a side of me that wants to enjoy it. And it makes the planning for the day difficult. So with me, you know, same thing with history. Every day I wake up, I was like, man, there's 30 or 40 books I could write that need to be written. But I'm only one person, so I'll focus on one.
Well, yeah, I love that because, you know, I faced that myself. You know, I faced that same question. You know, there's some days you wake up and I want to save the world. Of course, with the network, you know, that we built here in our expansion, you want to do that. On the other hand, you just want to be of the world. And it really is interesting to have that go through. But look, you're on a mission with this book. I mean, one of the things Woody said to you is you have to be absolutely factual. And for people that are just tuning in, you know, I let's take a moment. I thought about this today and I thought, wow, what if we'd have done this interview a month ago? You know, might Woody have been here? What if? But the thing I love about what you're doing, and which is so important for us to remember, you know, we are battling the backlash of large groups of people that don't believe the Holocaust even existed, don't even believe it, and don't quite understand what was at risk at Iwo Jima. Let's talk about Woody for a minute, because this book is called, and let's just make sure everybody knows, this book is called Flamethrower, and this is about Iwo Jima Medal of Honor recipient, U.S. Marine Woody Williams, and you are, Brian, you're the author of this. Let's take a minute, if we could. How can people get the book, but also how can they find out more about you? Because you've got a bunch of other great books out there.
Well, thank you, Pat. Well, you know, I have a website. It's my name, brianmarkrigg.com. Brian spelled with a Y like a Yankee, Mark with a K like in kilo, and then Rigg, two G's, R-I-G-G. So people can find about my work that way. They can also put my name into Amazon, and all my books are on Amazon, and Flamethrower is on Amazon, and free medium, Audible book, Kindle, as well as hardback. And then there's a lot of YouTube videos out there if people want to see stuff on my work. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a whole hour on Dateline about Hitler's Jewish soldiers.
Yep.
That is out there on YouTube if people want to find out more about me. So thank you for letting me do that plug, and that's how people can find out about my works and purchase my books if they would like to.
Well, I'm telling you, if people like you don't remind us of where we've been, we're not going to be able to recognize the signs of where we may go again. And this is really the plight of history. Yeah. And that's history untold. You know, if you're not on board what World War II was really about, then you're not going to be able to recognize the signs of this very interesting, almost silent World War III based on the way that war was started. But I want to take a minute. I want to talk about Woody, because he sure did get the award. And people are probably thinking, what are they talking about, Iwo Jima? What did he do? Hello, the book is called Flamethrower. So I want to talk a little bit about this, because we did lose a family member here. And, you know, it is one of the places of the war, I think, that is not talked about. We don't talk about what went on in the Pacific. You know, it's almost as if it was like a side dish or something. But, man, it was not, right?
Oh, man. Yeah, that's one thing that is. So I'll take the 10,000-foot view of that. Yeah. You know, this is not a sideshow, and then I'll get to your question about what did Woody do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you know, it's sad. I've been studying the World War II and the Holocaust since my undergraduate days at Yale University, when I was under James Crowley and Paul Kennedy and Henry Turner. And so I've been studying it since 1992. And if you look at World War II, for every book published on the Pacific, you have like 100 published on Nazi Germany and, you know, the fight against the Third Reich and Hitler. And so why the discrepancy? Well, I think the simple reason is this. You had a lot of Jewish scholars after World War II who were alive and living in England and Australia, America, and many who survived and went to Israel. And they wanted to know why the heck that a nation of Beethoven and Bach and Victor Stein and Nietzsche, why were they capable of slaughtering 6 million Jews? And so there was a lot of research, especially with Raoul Hilberg up in Vermont, a World War II veteran, Jewish man, who wrote, you know, The Destruction of European Jewry, and really got it out there in the 50s and 60s. And there was this intellectual community that really was diving into the documents and getting books published. Now, with Japan. Japan, a lot of people don't realize this, they slaughtered 30 million people, civilians, mostly Chinese, and they did it the old-fashioned way with bayonets and disease and bullets, and they were horrific. They raped everywhere. Rape of Nanking, some people know about, is endemic of everywhere they went. You have books written about rape of Hong Kong, rape of Beijing, and so on. So after the war, since most of the most of the victims were Chinese, you would think China would have been the perfect place to do most of the research and get this information out there. Well, unfortunately, you have a civil war going on in China. The nationalists lose by 1949. The communists take over. Mao Tse-tung is slaughtering more of his own people than the Japanese ever did. And he's killing the intellectual people who would be the ones writing the history. So it's very hard to point the finger at Japan to get this information out there when you're doing it to your own people and you're killing the very people who could actually write it up. So that's one reason. Also, we're a European nation in many respects, so we're kind of European-focused instead of Asian-focused, so there was less interest in it. But saying this is why there's not a lot more information out there. Saying all that, the Pacific War was much more complicated, much more difficult to do, and it deserves more attention because it was remarkable what we did of taking down Hirohito's regime that had taken over 1/7 of the circumference of the earth, and it was commanding over 600 million people. Hitler only commanded over 450 million people. So the Japanese regime was bigger, stronger in many respects, and it was spread over a lot more area, and that our Navy was able to power project across the Pacific. And we started out with 350 ships. We ended with 8,800. It's like, don't mess with us. You tick us off, we're going to come at you. And so that was what this amazing amphibious warfare and power projection that America was able to do on two fronts, in Europe and in the Pacific, was remarkable. And when you look at the naval and Marine Corps amphibious warfare capabilities in the Pacific, it is remarkable from a strategic point of view and a military point of view. Now getting to Woody being part of this puzzle. Woody was a demolition expert. That means he knew how to blow up stuff. He knew how to deal with all type of explosives. He knew how to deal with a flamethrower. And now, why was the flamethrower so important? Well, the Japanese in World War II, quite often, they were not on the islands that we attacked. They were in the islands. They were incredible moles or ants, if you will, and they would build these elaborate structures of tunnels and pillboxes. And on Iwo Jima, which we're talking about, it was an 8 square mile with 11 miles of tunnels interconnected with 5,000 reinforced positions of caves and in pillboxes and bunkers. So Woody, being a flamethrower expert, quite often was utilized to attack these positions because you couldn't blow them up, you couldn't shoot them. The only way to attack these positions, because they were in the ground, was to go up to them and pour flame into them. Now, the flamethrower, Woody was 160 pounds, 5'5". Mm-hmm. So have that in your mind when you realize that he carried 100 pounds of gear into battle. Two scuba tanks, if you will, full of fuel, of 4.5 gallons of diesel and high-octane aviation fuel, with a center tank of compressed nitrogen. And then he had a wand that was connected to that that could spray out flame 20 yards in front of him, and wide is about 20 yards as well. And it was 3,500-degree heat. It hit a body, and within 2 or 3 seconds, all the moisture was out of the body, and the body was on fire. 1/3 of the 20,000-man garrison of the Japanese had at Iwo Jima were incinerated. They were burned alive or suffocated because of the flames, because that was the only way to kill them. Now, Woody, being a demolition expert, the second day he was on the island, his company commander came to him and said, hey, we're getting slaughtered here. We can't get through this line. It was right north of the first airfield. There's pillboxes and trenches all over the place. Do you think you could take some of them out with a flamethrower? Woody said he would try. And he went into battle with these 100 pounds of gear. And he actually took out, you know, 2, 3, possibly 4 pillboxes. And he killed at least, you know, probably 8, maybe upwards to a dozen Japanese. And they were able to punch through this line and go several hundred yards forward. And that's why he got the Medal of Honor. And that was an example of hundreds of guys doing the same stuff on Iwo Jima in order to take over this island, to get the stepping stones, once again, with amphibious warfare and power projection, getting the stepping stones to get closer and closer to Japan.
Yeah, I'm so glad you talked about that in that way. And, you know, we have seen Woody, for those of you out there that have not, you know, we've seen Woody walk on football fields. We've seen Woody, you know, being recognized here. But what we don't know is the story that is being told right now in this book. And if you're somebody like me, you understand that you have, you know, you have dad born in Norway, right? My adopted father born in Norway, him and his brothers enlisted. And they end up over in the Pacific, and you could not get any of them to talk about it. The only remnants we have of this is a sword, Japanese sword, and a Japanese gun, right? To this day, we still have those. But to have a conversation about this and the loss of his brother, have a conversation of what went on in the Pacific, you couldn't get him to talk about it. And we learned early on, it was too painful, and the loss of his brother. And so, see, this is the part that we just don't remember. We don't remember the why. Now, Woody is a perfect example of somebody that looked like the guy from Captain America before he became Captain America, right? You know, thin, he was... right? But this war had it gone the other way, and this is what folks don't know. I mean, it may sound gruesome to those of you listening, but this is war. If you don't think that something similar isn't going on right now in the Ukraine, I just want you to say hello to yourself. Had we not have been able to take the edge, you and I would probably be having a very different conversation, wouldn't we?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, we were isolationists at the time. We didn't want to get involved with the war. And in many respects, the world needs to thank Japan for their idiotic decision to attack us at Pearl Harbor, because there was no strategic follow-up plan. And it awoke, you know, the giant. And we started supplying, you know, Europe in droves. And then Hitler, a few days later after Pearl Harbor, declared war against us. And it turned us from an isolationist country to a country very determined to defeat these two fascist warmongers, Hirohito and Hitler. And had we not gotten involved, millions more people would have died. Europe would have come under the shadow of Hitler, no doubt.
Yeah.
So the world needs to thank us in many respects for bringing down these two regimes, because they were not doing humanity any favors.
You know, you and I could probably do a whole show. Who is it? Yamamoto. I think it was Yamamoto. I apologize if I get my names mixed up. But I remember, you know, studying this in depth about Pearl Harbor and the difference between where you and I are today and a decision that a fleet admiral made not to do a third wave on Pearl Harbor is the conundrum of the century for war people to look at. When or war strategists look at this, everybody scratches their heads. They don't quite understand why the Japanese, in a perfect position, didn't finish the job. And I'm very grateful they didn't. Because when we're thinking about this, you have to flip it over to some of the other strategies that Japan put in place for World War II. And Iwo Jima was one of them. You know, when you were describing Iwo Jima, I couldn't help but think of Vietnam. I just couldn't. Because if you know people that have gone to Vietnam, and we know what happened in Vietnam, Iwo Jima was the same setup. I mean, it's not like you are fighting somebody that was just landed on the beach. They were there, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and one stat that people just find horrifying is that we lost 7,000 Marines in 36 days of combat. We lost more American boys on Iwo Jima in just 1 month than we have lost servicemen and women in Afghanistan and Iraq in the last 30 years.
Yeah, my uncle was one of them. I totally agree.
Yep.
Look,
and his
I wish
name?
John, Bjorn, John, Pete. I wish I had more time. These were people. So let me just talk about this. You talk about enlisting. These people were born like in another country, and they're like, we have to fight for the United States. So we don't talk about that enough. But this is about Woody, and this is what I want to say. I hope you keep taking this word out. I hope you take the word out about all your books. I hope you remind people over and over and over again what a slippery slope this is. Because if we're not reminded of this, we can't even be aware when the insidious nature of this kind of atrocity starts creeping in. I want to thank you for today. I got one question again for you. Please let folks know how they can get the book. I could talk to you for hours about this. Everything is in the book. I love that you put pictures in the book. Everything is here. You've laid this out so beautifully. You kept your promise to Woody to make it factual and yet make it very intriguing, interesting, and deep-heartedly sad. So thank you for all of that. How can we get a copy of the book? And again, how can we find out about you? And then my last question is, I'd love to know your personal message.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, you know, they can get my book on Amazon, you know, A Flamethrower. Here again, three mediums, Audible, Kindle, and the hardback. My name again is Brian Mark Rigg. They can get more information about my books with my website. And my personal message, you know, especially with everything that we're talking about, is like, get involved. Freedom is not free. Democracy is nurtured by people stepping up and making this world a better place, whether that be coaching a little league team and teaching people about teamwork, or whether it's getting on your school board, or in retirement, maybe going and teaching. Just get involved. Be proactive. Be an actor. Don't be a critical analyst about things. You see the problem, go get involved and get your hands dirty. And that's what the generation of World War II has taught me. Getting involved and making a difference makes this country stronger. And that's what we should do.
Wow, thank you so much. Again, what's your personal website one more time?
BrianMarkRigg.com.
Dr. Brian, thank you so much for this. Thank you so much for really bringing out this information. Thank you for honoring those that have served. And thank you for reminding us how close we do come on a daily basis to reliving something that none of us want to relive. Thank you so much for everything.
Thank you, Pat, for having me. Have a great day.
You too. Hey, everybody, let's take a short break.